KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Tell him that we love him and we are here and we are not going anywhere until we'll be okay, until he will stand on his leg by himself.
Hours ahead of a ceasefire, Israel waits for hostages to return and Gaza waits for peace. For Saturday, January 18th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, we hear the sounds of the early desperate fight to stop the fires tearing through Los Angeles.
Our folks are starting to report that they're running out of water in the hydrant systems.
We get the details on a busy week at the Vatican for Pope Francis, and we talk innies, outies, lumen, and defiant jazz with the cast of Severance.
I get it. We all need a reprieve.
All of a sudden, you're selling Severance to me.
Plus, why Hollywood can't quit the biopic, even when the results could be mixed. Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Gaza ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is scheduled to start early tomorrow morning. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has more.
Day one, tomorrow, the releases begin. Hamas is supposed to free three female hostages, and then the Israelis are supposed to release 30 Palestinian prisoners for each of them. And then there should be weekly releases and the beginning of a troop withdrawal, a surge of aid into Gaza, and some displaced Palestinians should be able to go back home in the north. But negotiators still need to talk about what the upcoming phases are supposed to look like and hopefully bring an end to the war.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reporting. But Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's treating it as a temporary one and says he retains the right to continue fighting if necessary. Thousands of protesters took part in the People's March today on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., just days before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. It comes nearly 8 years after the Women's March, where 500,000 people came together in Washington to protest Trump's first inauguration. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
More than a dozen left-leaning groups organized the People's March, but it comes at a time when some anti-Trump voters are feeling exhausted by politics.
I am tired of fighting, but who's going to do it?
Rachel Izzo attended the protest. She's a nurse who works in D.C.
As frustrating as it is to have this happen again, I feel like we have to all come together for whatever cause we believe in that is going to be affected by this presidency and all have our voices heard and not stay quiet.
Despite a smaller crowd than 8 years ago, organizers say they're focused on bringing new people into the movement and doing long-term organizing. Elena Moore, NPR News, Washington.
TikTok says it's planning to go dark tomorrow. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the video sharing app says it has no choice but to switch off its servers unless the Biden administration assures the company it won't enforce a law banning the app in the United States.
The Supreme Court upheld the law. That means if the app stays up and running, companies that work with TikTok could start to face steep financial penalties. Many on the app are grieving with tongue-in-cheek videos. Others, like TikTok user Charlotte Parler, are criticizing the government.
What do you mean that you're about to ban an app headquarters in Los Angeles? What do you mean you're going to ban TikTok, but you're not going to force Meta to stop selling our data to foreign entities?
TikTok is based in the Los Angeles area, but the company's corporate owner, ByteDance, is in Beijing. And officials in Washington fear the Chinese government could covertly manipulate the app. Biden officials say enforcement of the law will be up to the incoming Trump administration. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
And President-elect Trump tells NBC News he'll most likely give TikTok 90 days to work out a deal to avoid a U.S. ban. This is NPR News. In Spain, dozens of people were injured. Many were trapped after their ski lift collapsed at a resort in the Pyrenees near Spain's border with France. Officials say some 80 people were trapped and left hanging in that chairlift. Rescue crews are working to get them down. No word on the cause of the cable collapse. NFL playoff games are being held this weekend, with the winners advancing to the conference championship round to determine who goes to the Super Bowl. Alex McLennan of member station WDET reports that includes a game tonight between Detroit between the top-seeded Lions and the Washington Commanders.
After a 15-win season, the Detroit Lions are betting odds favorites to win the Super Bowl, and that's new territory for fans who once wore paper bags over their heads at Ford Field. The Lions were the first team to lose every game in a season. Now, they are one of the loudest and most passionate fan bases. Lions head coach Dan Campbell, who played on the winless 2008 team, says the city was always hungry for a winner.
It was one of the things that, for somebody like me, was appealing about playing here, wanting to play here, and coach here. This is a sleeping giant for football.
The Lions are hosting a young Washington Commanders team who won their first playoff game in 19 years last week. For NPR News, I'm Alex McLennan in Detroit.
And in college football, the national championship will be held Monday night in Atlanta, where Ohio State plays Notre Dame. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. After more than 15 months of intense fighting, an Israel-Hamas ceasefire is set to come into effect in Gaza on Sunday morning. The goal is a permanent end to the deadliest conflict ever between the two sides. But as the ceasefire goes into effect, many complications remain. To walk us through it, we're joined now by NPR's Greg Myrie from Tel Aviv. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Scott.
So let's start with this. How would you describe the mood among Israelis and Palestinians on the eve of the ceasefire?
There's really a sense of relief on both sides after this exhausting war, and particularly for the Palestinians in Gaza. Now, we've seen some small celebrations among Palestinians and among Israelis. There's a rally in Tel Aviv this evening in support of the hostages. Here's Sharon Calderon, the sister-in-law of Ofer Calderon. He's listed as one of the 33 hostages who's supposed to be released by Hamas in the coming weeks.
I hope that he's well enough to hug him, to be there, to tell him what he has lost at the last 470 days.
On the Palestinian side, there's almost universal support for the truce. There's also very strong support overall on the Israeli side, though some on the far right believe Israel has made too many concessions to Hamas.
Okay, so that's the mood. Now, can you walk us through what happens tomorrow, or what's supposed to happen tomorrow, at least, when the ceasefire goes into effect?
Yeah, it's supposed to start at 8:30 a.m. local time. Israel has been carrying out airstrikes since the deal was first announced on Wednesday, but if calm prevails, hostage and prisoner exchanges should begin in the afternoon. On Sunday, Hamas is set to release three Israeli women, while Israel has committed to releasing 95 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. A lot more food and medicine should start flowing into Gaza in the coming days. But Scott, it's important to understand this will be a very drawn-out process. The first phase stretches for 6 weeks, and Hamas will only release 33 of the 98 hostages during this period. Israel will scale back its troop presence in Gaza, but it won't remove all its forces until later.
A ceasefire and freed hostages are things that so many people have been desperate for since the early days of this war. Negotiations stretched on and on. They seem to break down so many times. Why do you think it all came together now?
I'd point to three reasons. One, critics of Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu said he'd been stalling partly because it was a U.S. election year. He wanted to keep his options open until he saw who the next president would be. We should note the ceasefire agreement looks almost identical to proposals President Biden made last May. So the actual proposal hasn't really changed, but from Netanyahu's perspective, the circumstances are now much more favorable in his view.
And Greg, is it fair to say Netanyahu far prefers a Trump administration over a Democratic one?
Yeah, that really is true. And more specifically, a second reason this is happening now seems to be Trump's insistence that an agreement be reached before he assumes office on Monday. Trump said his new Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, to join President Biden's team in negotiating the deal in the Gulf state of Qatar. If there was no deal, then Trump and Netanyahu could have had a rocky start. With the deal, it looks like they'll be in alignment, at least for now.
So those were two reasons. You said three different factors were top of mind here. What's the third?
Yeah, Hamas was badly weakened and increasingly isolated. Israel was not only battering Hamas, it was also hammering Hamas ally Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah signed a ceasefire with Israel back in November, also from a position of weakness. And Israel struck some very heavy blows to Iran, which supports both Hezbollah and Hamas. So this alliance lost much of its punch, and it poses much less of a threat to Israel today than it did just a few months ago. Hamas, in particular, found itself badly beaten, its leadership wiped out, and no real prospect of getting help from its allies.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie joining us from Tel Aviv on the eve of a ceasefire. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
The fires that have devastated parts of the Los Angeles area the past couple of weeks, how exactly did they get so out of control so fast? There were a lot of factors at play, including fierce winds whipping the LA area at the time. At 10:48 on the morning of January 7th, firefighters in the Pacific Palisades section of the city radioed out a warning about a blaze. They said it was still small, but that it threatened to grow quickly.
Just to give you guys a heads up, currently it's a 10-acre brush fire and heavy fuel on top of a ridge line. It is 100% in alignment with the wind. This has the potential for 200-plus acres in the next 20 minutes, but it is pushing directly towards Palisades, and this thing's got a wide path to travel already.
What started as that 10-acre brush fire has now, so far, consumed more than 23,000 acres. NPR's investigations team downloaded more than 2,000 hours of communications between first responders. And that audio shows how crews trying to control the fires ran into a huge problem with the water supply. Here's more on that from NPR's Kiara Eisner.
Just 8 hours after the first responders saw that brush fire, a firefighter sent out an urgent message on the radio.
If you can get a hold of any sort of public works or DWP, our folks are starting to report that they're running out of water in the hydrant systems.
The dispatcher jumped in to say people were trying to fix the problem.
Copy that. It's being worked on.
6 minutes later, a firefighter suggested sending a truck that transports water, called a tender, to the scene.
With us losing our water up here, is there any way we can get a bunch of water tenders through the city? And we can keg them up at least in a safe area up in the Palisades, and we can set up a portable hydrant system so our folks can have a shorter turnaround time.
But reaching the fire was not easy. As fire trucks and tenders tried to rush there, they had to fight through crazy traffic.
71, you've got gridlock on Palisades Drive. People are driving down both sides.
And the fire itself kept moving.
With the wind that we're experiencing up here, and I'm looking across canyon, that's where it looks like it's headed.
Nearby, a super scooper was providing support from the air. That's a plane that scoops up water from lakes or other reservoirs to dump on fires.
LA County, Quebec 2, flight of two super scoopers just leaving the fire scene at this time. We're showing Van Nuys in about 3 minutes.
NPR journalists transcribed and analyzed communications from 13 audio feeds streaming LA City and County first responder channels. The feeds were downloaded from Broadcastify.com, a live audio streaming platform. By Tuesday evening, the communications show conditions were getting increasingly dangerous.
Yeah, Operation Helco on command, we are going to be grounding all aircraft based on the wind conditions right now. We're ineffective, and we're not going to compromise safety, so all rotorcraft are going to go back to Van Nuys. You have no aircraft on the incident right now.
And by 2 a.m. the next morning, first responders were organizing rescues.
Yeah, we've done an ALS transport of a chest pain, possible CO poisoning of a firefighter to West. We're getting a report of a patient needs to be evac'd on a ventilator, and they've lost power.
But a few minutes later, the radio communications again turned to the water problem.
We've lost most of the hydrant pressure in Zulu.
By the time the firefighter issued that update from a section of the Palisades fire, other parts of L.A. had already started burning.
We are now on scene of a structure fire on Altadena.
The Eaton fire near Altadena had started Tuesday evening at the base of the Angeles National Forest. That's about an hour's drive northeast of Palisades. Just after midnight, in the early morning on Wednesday, the water appeared to be running out there, too.
Truck 82, we have multiple fire alarms and tree fires, bush fires.
Copy that, L.A. We do not have water.
And by 6 a.m., firefighters near the Altadena neighborhood were mentioning problems with hydrants.
We're having some water supply issues. Some of the hydrants are going dry.
The communications indicate this came as a surprise to the first responders.
Were you having any issues like that before?
No, negative. I haven't heard of anyone having issues with the hydrants. Let me check and see if they can boost the pumps, or it could be the tanks are getting low.
And just past midday on Wednesday, a firefighter made a dire announcement.
Hey, I see operations just further. We're up at Lake in Altadena, and all the hydrants up here are dead. We're working on trying to find water for them.
California Governor Gavin Newsom ordered an investigation last week into how the fire hydrants lost pressure and how they stopped providing water. City officials say the system was never designed for large wildfires like Palisades or Eaton. It was designed for house fires or urban fires. But in a letter the governor wrote to the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, one of the utilities in charge, Newsom demanded answers. On the radio channel, a first responder also thought about reaching out to the water company.
Just checking to see if we have a representative from the water department so we can maybe work on our water supply issues.
But in the meantime, there was only one thing they could do.
Pick your best targets of opportunity the best you can. We're having real problems with water. No water at all. So do your best.
Reva Duncan is a former fire chief with the U.S. Forest Service. She says that sort of response is often the only option.
When they run out of water and they're in that kind of situation, then they have to kind of do triage. Do we have to move, you know, even farther over where we can be effective and efficient with our water and at least try to stop some kind of progress of the fire?
Firefighters are trained to keep their cool when communicating on the scene and over the radio. But Duncan says it's still devastating to run out of resources.
It's hard for us to watch people's homes burn down and them lose everything, especially when it's the situation where there's so little that firefighters can do at that time.
More than 40,000 acres have burned in L.A. so far across the different fire regions. That's an area three times the size of Manhattan. Both the Palisades fire and the Eaton fire are still burning today. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A blast of Arctic air is forecast to hit the Mid-Atlantic area tomorrow through Monday, and that has President-elect Trump moving his swearing-in ceremony for his second term inside the Capitol. Tomorrow, he holds a rally at the Capitol One Arena in Washington. In Los Angeles, fire officials say the largest of the wildfires, the Palisades Fire, is now around 43% contained. And the second biggest one, the Eaton Fire, is now at 73% containment. This as officials search for the cause of the fires. And the Department of Justice is accusing Walgreens of filling millions of prescriptions without checking to see if they were legitimate. Officials say it's been going on for more than a decade. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It has been a big week for Pope Francis. His new memoir, Hope, published in 80 countries, is the first time a sitting pontiff has published a full memoir. In the middle of the week, the Vatican announced an agreement between Washington and Havana for the release of over 500 Cuban prisoners, as well as a plan to lift the island's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. And amid all of that, Francis won a big award from a close global ally. President Biden awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom with Distinction, which is the highest civilian honor the U.S. hands out. Here to put it in context is Nicole Winfield, AP's Vatican correspondent. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the memoir. You read it and reviewed it. What stood out to you?
This does cover a lot of territory that we're all pretty much familiar with, the childhood in Buenos Aires and then progressing into the key priorities as Pope. I'd say what jumped out at me is that we finally have a little bit of retrospection, a little bit of self-criticism, primarily of some things that he did when he was younger that he regrets. So it's not just a biography. There's kind of the added value of, in his own words, the Pope saying, yeah, I really could have done that better.
You and other articles I read about it had a similar conclusion, that there are areas where Pope Francis was not too forthcoming, whether they were controversial areas or areas of his life where there's still kind of some mystery as to what actually went on. Curious, what are one or two portions of his life that you would have loved to have read more about in this memoir?
Yeah, so I think anyone who covers the Pope, we are all just curious beyond belief about what happened in Cordoba. So this is a period of his life. He's a young priest. He has already served as the provincial of the Jesuits in Argentina. But then from about 1990 to 1992, the superiors back in Rome exiled him to Cordoba, Argentina, to serve as a confessor. So no one really knows what he did or how he got on the bad side of the superiors to have earned essentially a demotion, a fairly serious demotion. He has spoken of it really in fleeting terms. In this book, he only speaks of the dark night as if it were one of these crises in faith, as if he had to find himself again. One would have hoped that in the autobiography, he might finally have become a little more transparent. The other one that jumped out at me, just because it's an issue that I've covered quite closely, is he doesn't seem to give a lot of attention to the clergy sexual abuse crisis. He talks about it a little bit, but not at the length or level that I would have expected.
Let's shift to this agreement between the U.S. and Cuba. This isn't the first time the Vatican has facilitated prisoner releases in Cuba. There were some tied around papal visits from Pope John Paul, from Pope Benedict. The Cuban regime released hundreds of prisoners at those times. I'm curious, does this particular agreement strike you as unique in any way?
I wouldn't say so. As you say, we have seen this kind of constant dialogue, triangulation almost, between the U.S., the Vatican, and Cuba. This one is unique, I guess, because the Cuban government is attributing it to the Holy Year. So that is kind of the novelty, that this is not a Pope trip, but we have a Jubilee, which has just gotten started in Rome. And one of the key things that Pope Francis asked for in the papal bull announcing this Jubilee was for governments to offer gestures of clemency, amnesties, pardons. This is a common thing for jubilees, but they only happen every 25 years.
And this is a president that the Pope has a relationship with, has met several times. They've corresponded. They've talked on the phone. I mentioned the Medal of Freedom that Biden awarded him, which he did after an in-person visit had to be canceled due to the wildfires. All of that changes Monday. Any sense in the Vatican how the Pope is going to approach a second Trump presidency?
This papacy obviously will do what it has to do. It has to work with the Trump administration. The U.S. Bishops' Conference does lean a little conservative, so we can expect that there will be, at least on the official level, good relationships. There are common points of interest. Obviously, the Vatican is very much opposed to abortion. You know, we might not have that close personal connection that there was between Pope Francis and President Biden, but there will be obvious points of contact and cooperation.
Last thing I want to ask about, amid all of the things that happened this week, the Pope fell and injured his arm. He's 88 years old. It's the second time he's fallen in a month. How much concern is there in and around the Vatican right now about his health?
I think this is different. This is not the bronchitis that we're used to seeing every winter. Mm-hmm. So this is an indication of fragility, more so than what we've seen in the past. We know he's got bad knees. We know he's unstable on his feet. But these domestic falls at someone of his age, anyone who has a grandparent knows that they can be quite serious.
Right.
So also because the last Pope, when he fell, Pope Benedict was on a trip to Mexico in 2012, fell at night, hit his head, and it is now universally believed that that fall is what really sealed the deal for him to decide to retire. So falls are a big deal, and I think we're all looking at this one quite seriously.
That's Nicole Winfield, AP's Vatican correspondent. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm currently in an NPR studio doing my job, but in the world of the TV show Severance, once I left this building, even this floor, I would not remember any of it. The show's premise is that there is a procedure, a very uncomfortable looking one, that splits people's consciousness.
They say it doesn't hurt.
Just relax. I'm very excited to meet you.
If you undergo it, you have no clue what happens inside the office, and your work self or any knows nothing about your outie's life away from work.
So I'll never leave here.
You'll leave at 5. But it won't feel like it, not to this version of you anyway.
Do you have a family?
You'll never know.
Severance is now back for its highly anticipated second season on Apple TV+. And for people like me who got obsessed with season 1, the follow-up season has a lot of questions to answer. It goes deeper into the shadowy corporation of Lumen, the life and death mysteries, and the romances driving the plot. If you don't want the first season spoiled or to hear even mild hints about the second season, consider this your warning, because we're about to get into it with some of the show's breakout stars, Tramell Tillman and Britt Lauer. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
When I've had conversations about Severance, I'm describing it to people, or I'll mention that maybe Ben Stiller is an executive producer. They hear the premise of the show, they hear that, and they go, oh, is this funny? Is it a comedy? Is it a drama? Like, how do you answer that question? Because there's incredibly funny moments in Severance, and there's incredibly dark, serious moments in Severance. Like, how do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's like a workplace drama with a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a dark sense of humor. And there is a thrilling aspect to it. But there are so many ways in to this show. There's the puzzle box aspect. There are some sci-fi elements. And then at the end of the day, it's really about these very human and relatable journeys that these characters are on, asking these deep questions of who am I? And who am I in relationship to my work specifically? And then in season 2, it's really becomes a question of like, who am I in relationship to these people who I care about so much, whether that's my given family or my chosen work family.
Tramell, you play the company man, Seth Milchick, who's Helly's supervisor. I'm curious, like, I'm obviously not going to ask you what it is, but how up to speed are you? How read in are you on the broader picture of Milchick as you approach the role each season?
I find that I'm learning it as I go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's really lovely is that this process of Severance from the very beginning has been incredibly collaborative. And in a very interesting way, it feels so much like Milchick. Mm-hmm. In season one, he has some answers, but he doesn't know all the answers. And as he progresses in season two, we see that he's promoted and he has access to more information. But I think there's so much more that he is unaware of in this world of Lumen.
And we're going to come back to some of those moments he finds himself in season two in a moment. But Britt, I want to ask you a question about your approach to acting this role, because you play Helly, you're playing Helena, and as the season goes on, it's clear that both of those roles, one of them in particular, is even more complex than it was before. And I'm wondering how you think, how actively you think about the body language and the posture and just the way that you present these characters who are physically the same person, but mentally and spiritually very different people.
I kind of started from a place of what they shared, which is they're both trapped. For Helena, on the outside, she's trapped within a company she was born into. And she's often being observed. Anytime you see Helena, there's someone else in the room with her. So that, yeah, you know, affects the way that she behaves. And then for Helly, she's kind of the complete opposite. And she's moving through the world on a really clear mission, a really physical mission, especially in season one, to escape at all cost. And much like Tramiel was saying, that there's this meta quality of, you know, what bleeds through from the innie to the outie and what bleeds through the information of what Britt, the actor, knows and what the characters know. There's a shared subconscious, there's a shared body. And so, yeah, there's this kind of cool meta quality of what information is available to both consciousnesses.
Tramiel, I want to ask you a couple questions about a really interesting plot point that I'm going to try very hard not to give too many details about. But there is a point where Milchick, as a black man in leadership in a company that has literally deified its white founders, is made aware that he's a black man in a predominantly white company. And I'm wondering how you thought about this plot arc, how you approached these scenes and these moments for this character.
Well, in order to answer that question, I have to speak to where we started in season one. I remember having conversations to talk about the racial makeup of the town of Keir, which I started to see was very diverse, and also to speak about the racial dynamic of Lumen. And so my question to the creatives was, does this man know that he's black? And what does that mean as he steps through a culture that looks very different from him? And are we going to address that? So the charge was then, how do we tell this story without losing focus on the journey of the innies, but still pay homage and respect to the fact that this man is a black man who knows that he is black in a world that he stands out?
And I think this particular moment gets to a lot of the interesting stuff about the show, because Lumen makes an overture to Milchick that is incredibly garish and shocking. And yet a lot of the stuff in the show is actually like pretty close to actual workplace culture, which is horrifying to think about.
Absolutely. Which I think is so alarming because this instance, this circumstance is very familiar.
Do either of you see the upside of a severance procedure, like when it's spelled out? Is there any part of you that thinks, like, I could see some of the appeal to that?
I get it. I understand. You know, and especially in the world that we are in, we all need a reprieve.
That's a very Milchick thing to say, Tramiel.
It's very, you know, I appreciate that. Thank you.
All of a sudden, you're selling severance to me.
The
like,
question
oh,
is whether or not it's
so
working.
Soothing. But Tramiel, did you see that long, that very long needle that they put into my brain? Did you see it?
But you didn't feel a thing. You felt nothing. It was a dream. Milchick was there to hold your hand, to support you.
I don't know. That drill going into the skull, like, you can't forget that.
Nope.
Can't unsee it.
But to Tramiel's point, I think there is, yeah, of course, like that's such a human thing, right? To be like, oh man, I wish I could numb myself to this uncomfortable part of life, mm-hmm. whether it's a part of your identity or a part of life that's just a bummer, or something really dark or grief. And I think the question that the show poses is, you know, is it worth skipping over those parts of life, or is moving through those things part of your identity and what makes you whole?
That is Britt Lauer along with Tramiel Tilghman, who both star in season 2 of Severance. The first episode is on Apple TV Plus now. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Residents of Washington, D.C. gathered today to honor Martin Luther King Jr. Day with an annual peace walk 2 days before the official holiday. President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration, which is Monday, loomed large at the gathering. Sarah Y. Kim of member station WAMU reports.
Every year for Martin Luther King Day, people gather in Southeast D.C. at the intersection of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X Avenues. The annual walk honors Dr. King and his legacy. Reverend Wanda Thompson, pastor of the Ambassador Baptist Church, says they're bearing the torches of black women too, like civil rights activists Fannie Lou Hamer and Rosa Parks.
Black women, don't let anybody tell you that you cannot do, because you have always done.
Speakers at the rally alluded to the election and said the walk was a call to action for peace and loving their community. Thompson said the greatest enemy of civil rights isn't the incoming administration, but rather the fear to act.
I won't be afraid.
I won't be afraid.
I won't be afraid.
And if I'm afraid,
and if I'm afraid,
I'm going to push on anyhow.
I'm going to push on anyhow.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah. Amen.
The event was also a celebration, with a parade of bands and dance groups from local schools. Reverend George Gilbert Jr., executive director for the Center for Racial Equity and Justice, says it's not just about the birthday of the civil rights leader.
We still have to fight the fight of the civil rights movement of the 60s.
Gilbert calls President-elect Donald Trump a mouthpiece for racists and says Trump also has an antagonistic relationship with the district.
We're in a situation of not knowing how he will affect our city.
With Trump and a Republican-controlled Congress, there are concerns about more federal interference in D.C. Trump has threatened tighter federal control of D.C.'s government. Some residents even worry about whether the local government will continue to exist. Still, Gilbert says black people are hopeful and have been through the worst.
So whatever comes our way, we know that if we keep our hand in God's hand and we keep fighting and keep marching, keep speaking out against the atrocities of the world, that we will make a difference.
Daryl Ashton is with nonprofit Alliance of Concerned Men and gives the overdose reversal drug Narcan and food to people on the streets. Ashton is a native of Southeast D.C., and unlike most residents, he's a Republican.
These last 4 years have been brutal. Brutal.
Ashton says he loves being in the community. He's come to the parade in previous years. It brings Ashton a lot of joy.
First of all, unity, solidarity, good vibes, and just to come out and just celebrate with all the high schools and, you know, people just coming together, all nationalities, and just celebrating Martin Luther King Day.
The walk is in predominantly black Ward 8 and is a celebration of this area. Rebecca Beavers says she's proud of her native Southeast D.C.
Even though, like, it feels like we're going backwards, there's still, like, a sense that we're moving forward in regards to civil rights and equality for all.
For NPR News, I'm Sarah Y. Kim in Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
They used to be collaborators, but a few diss tracks changed things fast between superstars Drake and Kendrick Lamar.
They not like us. They not like
us. Drake has filed a new lawsuit, not against Lamar for his lyrical attacks, but against his own record label for publishing and promoting that song. We'll tell you more Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Preparations continue for a Gaza ceasefire between Israel and Hamas that's scheduled to get underway tomorrow. Hamas-held hostages and Israeli-held Palestinian detainees are set to be released. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today says he considers the truce temporary and will continue fighting if he sees the need. TikTok says it will close down in the U.S. tomorrow if the outgoing Biden administration doesn't act to keep them open after the Supreme Court ruled they have to sell to a U.S. company or shut down. President-elect Trump tells NBC once he's sworn in Monday, he will, quote, most likely give the social video app 90 days to work out a deal allowing it to avoid a U.S. ban. And the CDC is urging people hospitalized with the flu to also get tested for the bird flu. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Hanif Abdur-Raqib is one of the most interesting writers working today. His latest book, There's Always This Year, made the cut for one of NPR's favorite books in 2024. He writes about sports and death and love and family, which just so happen to be the kinds of topics they like to explore on NPR's show Wildcard. So here is Hanif Abdur-Raqib speaking with Wildcard host Rachel Martin.
Three cards in my hand. Pick one, two, or three.
Two.
Where would you go to feel safe as a kid?
I'm the youngest of four. And being the youngest of four, you know, I spent a lot of time alone. But the good news is this was during the era, this is in the 90s, it was a really robust era of college radio and radio in general. Hmm. And so where I went to feel safe was kind of inside of the world afforded to me by headphones. Huh. I would put headphones on and I would record songs off of the radio onto cassette tapes. I would be making mixtapes in real time off of the radio, which required a lot of precision. It required a lot of attentiveness. And, you know, you didn't hit stop on the tape when you're recording because that would be like a hard stop.
Oh, no, you had to hear the pause button. Depress. Yep. Oh, yeah. No, I remember.
And to wait by a radio all day and hear the DJ announce a song that is your song, that feels miraculous. I miss that feeling. I wish I could bottle that feeling. Feeling like something is being delivered just for you. Hmm. That's special.
Okay, we got three more cards.
Okay.
Three more cards. Pick one, two, or three.
Three.
Oh, that was like a gimme for you. What have you learned to appreciate about your hometown over time?
Oh, gosh.
You're like, where do I begin?
Yeah. You know, one story I like telling, not because I like reminding people that I've got a MacArthur, but because it's funny, is that the day that the MacArthur...
MacArthur Genius Awards, by the way, for those who don't know.
Yeah, the MacArthur Grant. The day it was announced, I had dinner plans with a friend, and these plans were, you know, like... set in stone for a while. And the day that that gets announced is a hectic day. It's like, obvious, it's a wild day. Like, you have to do a million different things. And so I was running behind, and this dinner was, you know, this friend had a plan after, I had a plan after, we were going to a concert, all this stuff. And so I was running behind, and I texted her, and I was like, you know, I'm running late, but I'll pull up. And I pulled up like, you know, 15 minutes late to dinner. And she put her hand on my shoulder and said, I'm very proud of you. You may be a genius, but you really messed up my dinner plans. And I love that story, not because it's so reflective of this thing in Columbus where people are proud of me and we are proud to live amongst each other, but no one's impressed, you know. And I have lived in this place my whole life. There are people here who knew me when I was a kid. There are people here who knew me when I was getting arrested. There are people here who knew me when I was sleeping on the streets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a thing about Columbus that I love, because people don't look at my life and career with a shrug. There's certainly a lot of affection, but the greater question that is always asked of me, and the question I have to rise to, is what kind of community member do you want to be?
Yeah.
What kind of neighbor do you want to be?
Was there any part of you, I mean, I'm talking to you when you're in New York right now. You know, New York is where the writers go, and LA is where the writers go. I mean, people can go anywhere now, but there are other places you could have lived and thrived and written. What was important to you about staying there?
I don't really know how well I know myself anywhere else. And I would, at this point, I don't want to find out. Mm. There's something about being unhoused in a place that you love, where I remember just walking the streets at night and feeling like the city belonged to me and only me, because you're at your most invisible then.
But being invisible made you feel ownership over the city?
I think so. Oh. At night, you know, like I remember walking the street and being aware that I had nowhere to sleep, but also being aware that that meant I had everywhere to sleep, you know? That gives you some kind of false sense of ownership, but you also see a city for what it is. Mm. You see through the kind of lies that a city might dress itself up in order to make itself marketable. Mm-hmm. So Columbus, for example, is now trying to market itself as like a tech city or food city, all of these things that don't actually serve the population that is living and breathing and actively there. Mm-hmm. But to be among that population and to be among a version of that population, in my case, where I was extremely at a margin, meant that I got to see the city's most honest face behind all of its false masks.
Yeah.
And to me, that I got to see that and say, you know what? I actually think I still love it. I still love the city as its most honest self, because I know what that most honest self is, and I can cut to the heart of it.
Last question.
All right.
Last set of cards. 1, 2, or 3.
Let's do 2. I started with 2. Let's do 2 again.
What's your best defense against despair?
So many of my friends now have kids, mm-hmm. you know, I don't have kids, but I don't remember at what point I realized that kids liked me. Kids really like me, you know, and I've always been like, kids are fine. Like, kids are cool. But you know, the past like 5 years, all my friends having kids and all of them kind of like gravitating towards me. Now I'm like, kids are the greatest. You know, I feel like I jokingly call myself like a freelance uncle, where I get to, you know, and it has changed me. It's like rewired me.
Yeah.
Despair is inevitable for me. I think that despair hovers, and I don't find ways to stop its hovering. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually fine with that, because I think that keeps me in tune with the realities of the world that need addressing. Mm-hmm. And it keeps me in tune with what I need to fight back against. And it keeps me in tune with a real rage that propels me towards love, you know? Mm-hmm. But also, I want to be the kind of uncle type figure who gets called when a date doesn't go well, or when someone's parents don't understand them and they want to talk to me, or when someone's putting on a prom outfit and they don't like the way they look in it, or when someone's, you know, needs a little money to go on a date. I want to live long enough to be that, because I feel like all of my friends who I love have carried new people into the world who are waiting for me to love them, and they are hopefully waiting to love me. And that means that I get to echo the love I already had for one person into a whole other generation of people. And that is enough to make me say, I just think I want to stick around. If I can help it, I want to stick around.
Hanif Abdurraqib, writer, poet, author, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel. We'll talk again soon, hopefully.
And you can find a longer version of that conversation on NPR's Wildcard Podcast. It is award season, and like many years before, that means at least one biopic is in the mix of nominated films.
200 people in that room, each one wants me to be somebody else. They should just let me be.
Let you be what?
Whatever it is they don't want me to be.
That is Timothée Chalamet as a young Bob Dylan. Nominated for a Golden Globe Best Actor Award, he is also considered a favorite to be nominated for an Oscar for his performance of Dylan during his early years in the folk music scene and his controversial decision to go electric. Another biopic getting award buzz is the Netflix film Maria with Angelina Jolie, starring as the famed opera singer Maria Callas.
Tell me how it felt to be on stage.
An exaltation. An intoxication.
Big stars playing iconic historical figures is, of course, Oscar bait. Think Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury, Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland, Jamie Foxx as Ray Charles, Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, and, of course, many, many, many others. So we wanted to dig into the appeal of biopics. What makes for good ones? What makes for bad ones? Why do they always become Oscar bait? We brought back in Mark Rivers, resident film fanatic here at All Things Considered. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Scott.
Let's start with one of those. Like, why every year does it seem like there's 17 different biopics flashing across my screen?
I think with biopics, there's a kind of like air of importance around them, right? When you're making a movie about Abraham Lincoln, or you're making a movie about, Leonard Bernstein, like there's an air of importance around these movies and a seriousness of intent, right? You have to take this history seriously.
Especially when it's like a big civil rights type figure, right?
Totally.
Like Harvey Milk, like Gandhi, like so many different examples.
There's almost a kind of like moral imperative to like get this kind of history right.
Right.
I think with musical biopics in particular, you think about how IP or intellectual property is so important these days. And what is Elvis, for instance, but like IP? You know, there's all this merchandise. You have clothes, you have the albums, you have museum exhibits. There's a built-in audience. You know, for the superhero movie, your son might like the new Avengers movie, but you might not, right? But you and your son might like Bob Dylan. So the audience can span generations, like a franchise movie, like a sequel. It's operating off the kind of built-in familiarity that you already have with the subject.
I just want to put a clarification that we're using the phrase biopic here, not biopic.
Biopic I'm gonna stick with, yeah.
It is fair to say that when they're pulled off, a biopic can be an incredibly powerful movie. I'm thinking about, like, let's take, like, you know, the last few decades. Malcolm X, I feel like this titanic movie.
We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us.
In a very different way, the Steven Spielberg movie Lincoln.
We're stepped out upon the world stage now! With the fate of human dignity in our hands.
I feel like, in two different ways, Malcolm X is the life story of this grand figure, and then Lincoln really zooms in, hones in on just one key moment. Two examples of taking a serious topic, like you said, taking a different approach to them, and making it work as a movie on its own. Agree? Disagree?
Definitely agree. I think it's interesting to have those two examples, because on the one hand, you do have Malcolm X. It has this broad sweep, right? And I think that can sometimes trip up other movies, where it kind of feels like the movie is just kind of showing a Wikipedia page. Just like, it looks like they're kind of putting a Wikipedia page on screen, right? Or they're just kind of hitting all the important life events.
Yeah.
I think the problem with a lot of other biopics is that they're hagiographies, right? Like they revere the subject. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of putting a halo around the subject. There are always shots of other kind of people like looking upon this person in awe, right?
Yeah.
And I think one thing this movie does, it forces you to empathize with Malcolm X. It's not just about his life, it's about the ideas that shaped his life. And nothing you see in the movie isn't shown to you that isn't a kind of a part of his ideological evolution. So by the end of the movie, you may not necessarily revere Malcolm X, but you can identify with and you can empathize with him. And I think the lesson of that movie, too, is that experiencing the things that he did, maybe you too could have become Malcolm X. Any one of us could have been a Malcolm X. And I think of that coda towards the end that kind of goes outside the narrative, where Nelson Mandela is like in that classroom and all those kids are standing up saying, I am Malcolm X, you know?
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
So like, it doesn't necessarily revere Malcolm X, it does, but it empathizes with him. I think that's a key difference.
There are also some very bad
biopics out there. And
too many.
Are there any warning signs for you of, like, this is a red flag in terms of the plot, in terms of the approach of the movie, in terms of, you know, like, the key beats of the movie?
Some of these tropes, particularly when it comes to musical biopics, are kind of so ingrained and well-worn. I think you probably remember that parody that came out back in 07, the Dewey Cox story. Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, right, where it just kind of made fun of movies like Ray or Walk the Line. It kind of hit those beats so aggressively and kind of, and so, like, unironically that it was just so easy to spoof.
Mr. Cox.
Give him a minute, son. Dewey Cox needs to think about his entire life before he plays.
Playing the historical figure, like we mentioned at the top, why do you think it's such a turbo boost being in the mix for best actor or supporting actor?
I think with something, you know, subjective and also kind of hard to judge as acting, I think one thing that playing a real person does for, say, like the Academy voters, they have something to compare the performance to. With something like Rami Malek and Freddie Mercury or Timothy Chalamet and Bob Dylan, they can say, well, all right, well, how good of a job he did, they can base that on just how well they copied a person they might already know. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very narrow way of, like, looking at performances. I think we need to expand what we think of when it comes to what is a great performance. It can't just be impersonation.
Yeah.
You know, some of the best performances in movie history, they were performances of people that did not exist, yeah. You know?
Do you have an answer of most disappointing biopic you've ever seen that you had really high hopes for and just fell flat to you?
I don't have an answer for that because I find most of them very cliched. I find most of them only kind of for the fans. And mm-hmm. I think we need to have, like, a moratorium on biopics. I think we need to kind of take a break.
If you could have a moratorium on superhero movies or biopics and you only get one, what would it be?
Oh. You know, I'm going to say superhero movies because they're pushing out all the other types of movies. And, and I don't think biopics are pushing out other types of movies.
Okay.
Like, but they both have kind of similar problems. And in a lot of ways, biopics are kind of superhero movies themselves. You know, someone like Lincoln is a real-life superhero in a lot of ways.
What's another example of a biopic that you personally really like?
Well, speaking of Dylan, I think one biopic that I really appreciate is from 2007. It's Todd Haynes' I'm Not There.
Yeah, that was so interesting.
You know, I didn't come out of some cereal box. There's no one out there who's ever going to be converted by a song. There's no Phil Oakes song that's going to keep a movement moving, or a picket line picketing. His songs act as a personal conscience.
And I think what makes it so interesting is that it's not really a biopic at all. It's kind of an anti-biopic.
Yeah.
You know, I think what Haynes does in the movie is he kind of has multiple actors to play different Bob Dylan personas, one of which is a young black kid, another one played by Cate Blanchett, who plays kind of electric Dylan. That allows him to create this kind of broader commentary on Bob Dylan as... The movie is less about Bob Dylan the person than it is about Bob Dylan the mythology, Bob Dylan the legend. I mean, obviously, Bob Dylan itself, like, is an invention. That's not even his real name, right? So I think the movie gets into how Bob Dylan is kind of a hodgepodge of all these different American idioms, right? Like, he's just, like, he himself is an American invention. And the movie kind of interrogates that idea of this kind of, like, self-invention of transforming and mutations that, like, the Bob Dylan of the early 60s is not the same as the Bob Dylan in the later 60s and 70s. So I think that movie kind of gets closer to what Bob Dylan has meant to America and, you know, meant to the culture than kind of straight up more conventional biopic would do.
That is NPR producer Mark Rivers. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
For Saturday, that's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Tomorrow, we will check in on the first day of that ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and take a closer look at President Biden's legacy on the last full day of his presidency. We hope you'll join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm with the new podcast series, Tech Unheard. Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to tech company leaders like Mike Gallagher from Titletown Tech, who are working to help shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
America, America.